Welcome to the 22nd episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm Luke DeCock. With me, as always, John Clockerty. I want to go ahead and apologize off the hop. Had some complaints about the audio quality of our interview with Tim Nestor last time out. Hopefully it'll be better today. We got a great guest, Mike Cousins, ESPN play-by-play announcer, Syracuse grad. He had a thing last weekend at the UNC-Clemson game where they got Ron Groover to wear his Apple Watch and then got the data at halftime to see how far he ran. And we'll talk about that with Mike in a little bit here. Good broadcaster, Boston Terrier owner, all kinds of good stuff there. But, John, we had some interesting stuff this week. I think we need to get into the block charge in the Nevada-Utah State game where the guy dunked on the guy and got called for a charge, Jordan Caroline.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we'll get into that.
Okay.
We're going to get into that. And we got a couple other things to talk about, but let's go ahead and bring on Mike Cousins of ESPN, podcast, early listener of the podcast, early adopter, and let's talk a little bit about what happened on Saturday in the Carolina game. Mike, thank you very much for joining us. This seems like a pretty good time to have you on. In the Carolina-Clemson game this weekend, you guys had a feature where you got Ron Groover's Fitbit data and had the exact mileage he ran in the first half. How exactly did that come about?
Well, that idea was born out of just a collaborative process between our production crew, myself, and Corey Alexander, who I think does about 12 ACC games a week. So there's not anybody in the ACC who he doesn't know. And so when we looked at the list of officials for that game, he was like, yeah, you know, I'm pretty friendly with these guys, so I figure I'll give it a shot and see if one of them has a step tracking device. Because knowing that the pace at which North Carolina plays, it was going to be a fast game. So he just went up to Ron Groover before the game, who happens to wear an Apple Watch. I called it a Fitbit on the air, so in the devotion to accuracy department, I failed there. But he had his Apple Watch on around his ankle, and so we got to show the graphic at halftime that I think he'd run somewhere in the neighborhood of like 2.6 miles during the first half alone. And so it was just as simple as Corey having a good long-standing relationship with one of the officials. And Ron came over and said, hey, at halftime, I'll text you a screenshot from my phone. That'll give all the up-to-date information. And then we turned that into a graphic and made a good conversation piece on the air in a unique way to talk about the fast pace of North Carolina.
John, when you wore your Fitbit when you were working, how many months?
No, I did. There were no Fitbits when I was working.
No.
No, that's right. We were lucky. We were able to get a good pair of running shoes and some whistles that might be given to us, but no Fitbits.
That was what was interesting, guys, about that was, you know, as he came out of the locker room and we talked about it a little bit more before the second half started. He said the last North Carolina game he did, he ran, I think, in total 5.4 miles. And for a usual game, an average game, he would run about 4. Wow. So it's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, but Mike, that includes his walking to the scorer's table, probably walking back and forth from the dressing room and so forth. I'm not sure that's all running.
Well, but we know it's a mile in a fourth or a mile, 1.4 miles more than a usual game, which
yes,
would include all that.
Oh, no
all
question.
Of your, all
absolutely.
Of your wandering.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. I'm glad you guys did that. That's a terrific idea. But it got me thinking, and this is one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on today is, you know, I joke all the time about sports writers and officials, that we have the same schedules. We travel a lot of the same places, have the same hours in some cases, and we get yelled at by everybody for being bad at our jobs, which is really the thing that John and I have most in common. But it struck me announcers are kind of the same way, and you mentioned Corey knowing, you know, Corey and his two ACC games a night, but you work in a lot of different leagues. You must interact or overlap with officials just out of basic travel to some degree.
Yeah, and it is a similar schedule where now where we're in the throes of conference play, I'm on the, you know, my schedule is Wednesday, Saturday are my games, but you have a travel day sandwiched on the other side of each of those days. So I'm on the road for 6 days a week with just being home for the full day on Monday. And, you know, I'm watching, we had our Carolina-Clemson game on Saturday, and then I flip on ACC Sunday night basketball of Georgia Tech and Boston College. And it's the exact same crew that did the game the day before at Little John, but yeah, it's a 2-hour drive. So that was good scheduling in that department. But you know where it hit me toward the beginning of my career, where I was catching a 6 a.m. flight, and since they all blend together, I can't remember where it was, but running into some of the officials from the night before on the bus from the rental car facility, and they're off to wherever they're going, and I'm fortunate, I'm going home. And there are, I want to say it's R.L. Bynum who will track sometimes what number game it is for the officials throughout the year that they're doing. And now granted, they're working in a lot more conferences, but I might be on basketball game 30 or 35 for the year, and some of these guys are in the 70s already. And every time I see that, it's just mesmerizing to me to know how much focus you have to do a game and to get to this level and to stay at this level. And I just think about how difficult that is to do it so well.
We need to get KenPom tracking broadcasters as well as officials.
So we can, that'd be good.
We can see when you're overworked. I was curious also, and this is, I don't know if this has always been the case, and maybe John can jump in a little bit on this, but it's sort of become, seems like, industry standard practice for whenever there's a sort of monitor review, the officials will come over and tell the broadcasters, certain commentators, certain analysts, color commentators, will make an extremely big deal about the referee coming over to talk to them. But I see it happen when it doesn't make the air sometimes, just that heads up about what happened. Is that something that's happened throughout your career? Is that developed lately? Is that, all right, John's already shaking his head, so it's just forget that part of the question. But how are some referees better than others at that, and does that help you do your job?
Oh, it helps immensely. I don't know that I have any, it's anecdotal. I don't track it, whether I've gotten more or less participation from the officials, but I think as I've been in college basketball more, this is now my 7th full season doing games for ESPN, you get a better rapport with the officials as well. So, from the pregame, they always come over, no matter what league, what crew, they always come over and shake hands and say hi. And being in the ACC year after year, you get to know the same guys over and over. So you'll catch up and maybe share a travel story, or they'll just ask how you're doing. And then when you become on a first-name basis with some of the guys, you don't feel uncomfortable if there's a stoppage in play and there's two officials at the monitor and one who's monitoring the court to call him over and just ask, hey, did you see what was going on? There was an instance, I did a Virginia-Georgia Tech game last week, and Bill Covington was one of the officials. He had a cough during the game, and so he had an inadvertent whistle on a play on the baseline, which just happened to be a time where Jack Salt had walled up as a defender. And so we blew the whistle, but he didn't mean to. And he came over and explained it to us afterward and said, well, hey, I blew the whistle. Not everybody heard it, because we at the table didn't hear it. It was in the far corner in front of one of the benches, but the players within his vicinity heard it. So he had to stop play because they had stopped playing. And so it had altered the flow of the game. But officials coming over is very helpful. I think of a game earlier this year at Virginia Tech where Lee Cassell had gone over to the scorer's table to explain something to, what we have behind the scenes in TV. There's an official stats person, and then there's a statistician who sits with us at the table. He had relayed it to the official statistician, but it didn't make its way over to us. And so he came over and said, hey, guys, I'm really sorry that it didn't make it over to you. And we said, hey, look, we understand you have a lot of things higher on your priority list than explaining that to us. But officials are really good about that. They're very helpful. And we sometimes, if we're not on top of their mind, which I certainly understand, they have no problem with us waving them down just to get an explanation. And it's always really good to be able to do that, because when they go to the monitor, you want to know exactly what they're looking at, especially, let's say there's a flagrant that is created in replay review. You want to know exactly what they saw so you can explain that to the audience.
And that doesn't happen in games around the triangle when you have Freddie and John wearing the headsets.
Two legends, absolutely.
I don't think either of them listens to this podcast, so that's just totally wasted. But Freddie Kiger and John Madry are kind of ACC legends for their scoring and stat work. Yeah, go ahead, John.
Hey, Mike, the reason, we put that in when I was the supervisor, I'm not sure exactly the year or anything, but we talked about it at our spring meetings, and we ran it by the commissioner. He says, it could be helpful because so often officials are trying to sort things out, and you have an obligation to your audience to let them know. And so we felt like we have three guys. Let's get one over there. Let them talk to the play-by-play people so they can get a clear understanding. Because what you might be interpreting, like I saw a play, and I think it had something to do with, I know what it was, and it actually isn't relevant to this one, but the officials might be talking about some clock operation that may have malfunctioned, and your group, your play-by-play guys might be trying to cover something totally different. And so any information that those officials can get to you, it helps you to clarify things, and it also helps the audience listen to it. But there was no pushback or no resistance by the ACC at that time when we thought that would be a good thing to do.
I think it's been great because there are so many people who are not on the inside of college basketball as just regular fans, and a lot of the tendency is to vilify the officials or to say, oh, well, we've got official X today and he's always out to get us. And that's just, it's not true. And the more and more interactions that I've had with officials, I understand how much they want to do a good job and how much they want to get it right all the time. You know, there will be close calls where, let's say, a guy's on a fast break and he goes for a layup and puts it off the window, and it could be a goaltend or it could be a block. It's really close. And a lot of the times the officials will come over to us and they'll ask after the fact, hey, did we get that one right? And they're always relieved to know that a majority of the time they did get it right. But they try just as hard as the players do, just as hard as we do on the broadcast, to get everything right. So I understand why people think that officials have it out for them, because it's a created narrative within fan bases, but it's really not true. And one of the things that I do as well, that I don't know how many other play-by-play people do this, but you know, we're fortunate at ESPN in our preseason college basketball seminar, when we all get together once a year, is that J.D. Collins will come in and he'll give us a tutorial on what's changed this year, what are the points of emphasis for the officials. And of course, it'll be fun this year going into a rules change year to see what happens. But I keep with me a single space, 2-page document that has some of the more frequently called things on there and the a summary of the definitions with some verbatim stuff from the rule book, so that I can have it at hand at all times. So I keep hook and hold, obviously important this year, and factors in screening, principle of verticality, and I keep the definitions for F1, F2, Class A technical, Class B technical, because when those things happen, I want to have it right there to be able to explain to the people at home what exactly the officials are looking for on the replay.
Do you remember your first hook and hold this year?
I really have not had very many, but when it did happen, I was ready for it, because it's just a strange physical entanglement that players find themselves in, so it appears pretty readily evident when it does happen.
You mentioned something earlier I wanted to follow up on about the officials coming over and asking for a thumbs up or thumbs down or whatever. Have you ever openly disagreed with a call that was obviously wrong on the air? How do you handle that when it's pretty clear that the replay is not flattering?
I'm not going to be shy about disagreeing with a call if I firmly believe, based on having seen something a number of times and having read the rule book, that I disagree with the way something was adjudicated. But I would never say that someone is you have to be careful about the way you say it. And I would never criticize someone as a person, but I would disagree and criticize the decision that they made. But you also have to consider that we get the benefit of watching it three or four times before the ball gets put back into play. They only get to watch it once at real speed. And like I said before, you know, the more I get to know the officials and you understand the human element, you're much less you criticize much less frequently and with a much more discerning eye, because you know how hard that job is. And we're, you know, when you talk about the officials coming over to the table, I wish that we could have that in football too. Obviously, the distance from the broadcast booth to the field is a barrier to entry for that. But at least, you know, and in baseball too, wouldn't it be great if when there's a replay review, you could have an official get on a microphone and say, hey, 10 seconds, here's what happened, let's move on. If we could do that in basketball too, because I think a lot of the times the people in the arena might not know what's going on either.
Yeah, that's true. And it seems like maybe in football they ought to have the replay official on a headset with your stats guy, the way that they, this, you know, just to jump in and say, here's what that review is about, or here's what we're looking at, even in real time, so you guys aren't just guessing and saying, is this targeting, is this a clock malfunction? I think that happens a little bit in basketball sometimes, where everyone's kind of looking at the replays and thinking it's this, and it turns out to be a clock or the shot clock. Or, I mean, I get confused sometimes too, and I obviously don't have the benefit of the officials coming over and talking to me most of the time. Once in a while.
Well, in football, they've got two guys in the replay booth, the one who is the replay official, and then there's a communicator as well who has a direct line to the producer in the truck who will often tell us what they're looking at.
Okay.
But those replays with targeting especially take way longer than in any other sport.
Yes, they certainly do.
Yeah, you know, Mike, I wanted to get back you making the announcers making a judgment or a comment on a play. Officials don't question or get concerned about when this play happens and you have an opinion whether it was the correct call or an incorrect call, and it's a 50-50 and it's really close. And you come and you say, man, that is close. I think he missed that. Or no, let's say it's the other way. I think he got that right. It really close. But then after you've had a chance, and you brought this up yourself, you have a chance to look at multiple replays, and now you say, wow, they missed that one. I officials don't think that's fair. They say, wait a minute now, you know, I didn't have that opportunity. I didn't have that chance to look at that. But he thinks the play is right, but then when the announcer gets it, and I have examples of that I could show, that the announcer comes back and say, man, they missed that one. But that announcer is privy to replays. And I just wish they would, you know, certainly make, wow, that's a close play. I think he got it wrong, or I think he got it right, as you're looking at it the same time the official is, but having an opportunity to replay it and look at it and then say, openly say, wow, they kicked that one. And I don't think that's fair to the official who didn't have that opportunity.
Hold on a second here, John. I think you buried the lead here. You have a list of grievances?
A few.
You have a record of announcers with whom you have issues?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But that sounds
shouldn't you be saving those for Festivus?
Yes, absolutely. We'll have a special Festivus whistleblowers where John's got a lot of problems
with
everybody.
I agree with you, and I think the more that we realize that everybody who's taking part in the game is human and is fallible, the more forgiving we'll be in watching those. And I'm sure I'm guilty of having done that before, because the players, officials, broadcasters are never going to have a perfect game, but I always do try and keep that in mind, and unless I really strongly agree with a call or disagree with a call and I think it was missed, I try to be much more measured in saying that, understanding that they only get to watch it once and we get the benefit of slowing it down to 25% speed.
Yeah, Mike, I will tell you this, the people that I'm talking about and the officials that talk to me about it's not you. Okay, I will tell you, it's not you, but it's your cohorts, some of them, that do a lot of games.
Yeah, he has a lot of friends who are announcers, but not these guys.
Well, you know what I appreciate, too, is, you know, I worked in the SEC a couple of years ago and would call Mark Whitehead from time to time, the supervisor of officials there, and Brian Kersey and I in the ACC have spoken on a number of occasions, but the ability to call and say, you know, there was a play, it was a Florida State-Miami game on a Sunday night earlier in this season where Chris Kumaji, who's 7'4", got called for a flagrant 2 going for a box out. He had his elbows up, and I didn't understand that call. And so I called Brian, and he walked me through it of why it qualified for a flagrant 2. And so that was, you know, an on-the-record conversation we've had. And there are other times where I'll say, off the record, you know, can you tell me why this happened and I disagree? And I always appreciate that people in those positions who – are way busier than I think most people would imagine, because they're getting it from all sides, whether it's administrators or talking to the officials and grading them, or coaches who are saying, hey, we got jobbed on X or Y or Z play. But to take time to talk to me and help me understand a play when, you know, it may not ever get mentioned on the air, but it does further my understanding of how the game is adjudicated.
Yeah, Mike, I may not have another opportunity to ask you this, but, you know, there's always been discussion about expanding the use of the monitor, especially on critical game-ending calls. And there's been some this year that have been game deciders, but because of the rules don't allow that play to be reviewed, officials' hands are tied. But I know that every year they'll sit down and they'll look at plays, and coaches will have an opinion about expanding the use of the monitor. And I can think just one example was the LSU-Kentucky game where there was a basket interference. But that's only one example. I saw a play just recently, I think it was the Nevada-Utah game, where the guy took a charge, and when I first saw it, I thought he might have been in the restricted area. But and that's not the important thing. Is what if he was in the restricted area and they called a charge, and that play's not reviewable? There was 33 seconds to go in that game. And Luke and I have talked about, once you start expanding that, you brought up a really good play in which a guy is taking the ball to the basket, and if it's on that backboard and it's touched, then it's going to be basket interference. But officials are, that's a very hard call. What if that's the last play of the game and that ball goes in, and they call it interference because it had already hit the backboard? And my point is, and I'm going on, do you have an opinion about how far we should go with these replays?
I don't know that I want to go too much further than we already have now. And if only because when you get into a really good game and things are really tight, like you mentioned, that LSU game a couple weeks ago, I didn't get the chance to watch it live because I was en route to my game that night. But following along on Twitter, 90% of the comments about that game were, oh, here's another video replay review. But I'd imagine some of the people who also said that would say, well, if we didn't have these replay reviews, well, we should have more because, you know, depending on who they're rooting for, because then my team could lose on a close play that should have been sent the other way. Can't we just accept that sports are supposed to be fun and that there's going to be some element of uncertainty to it all, and that it's not always going to be perfect? Because the more you do it, I mean, it is once you open that door, where do you stop, right?
Exactly.
You can just say, well, every play is reviewable, but then the game's not fun, it's not watchable, it's not airable for TV because it won't fit into a two-hour window anymore. So I like it where it is now, where, yes, sometimes there are more replay reviews than we'd like, but I think somebody made this comment this past week on College Game Day to say, if you're going to have a replay review, let's limit it to a minute, right? And then the monitor just shuts off, and especially for football. But for basketball, they're not excessively long. But if we set a minute, because the term in the NCAA rulebook for both football and basketball is indisputable video evidence. And if 60 seconds isn't enough to decide if something's indisputable, then let's keep it as it was called and move on.
Yeah, I'm on team no replay in general. I'd like to see it reduced, if not eliminated in some cases. John, not quite at that level, but yeah.
Yeah, but Mike, I just expect you actually have had two-hour games.
Well,
I haven't seen any of those yet. Yeah,
Virginia, Georgia Tech last week, I was back at my hotel in about an hour and 50 minutes. So that was,
yeah,
that was very much an outlier.
With Virginia, you have a chance. Absolutely.
You have a chance. Yeah. Mike, thank you very much for your time. We'll have you back for the special Festivus Whistleblowers for sure. And we'll look forward to seeing you around.
I got a lot of problems with you. No, I'm kidding.
Hey, Mike, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Mike's really good. I think he's on top of stuff like this. I'm really glad we were able to have him on. He understands, as you can tell from the interview, he understands a lot of what we're talking about here.
He absolutely does. And I've not talked to him or met him before, but I'd like to sit down and have a beverage with him and spend some time with him, because he's done his homework. He talked about having a notepad and having some of the critical plays that officials and rules that sometimes is helpful to let his audience know, and that's special. I mean, like, he talked about some verticality plays and hook and holds and flagrant ones and flagrant twos and how you interpret those, and he's watching JD's
weekly whistle
videos. Weekly whistle, and he wants to be good at what he does, and he certainly sounds really prepared.
Sounds like you'd rather him host this podcast instead of me.
No, that's not true. but if you do go on the injured reserve, we might pull Mike in.
Speaking of injured reserve, let's start with our old friend McCaffrey.
I thought you were going to talk about Mike Eads.
We could. Let's take a break from all the controversy. Mike Eads came back from the injury, worked a few games, made it to the Duke-UNC game. Re-injured his knee in that game and is now out for the year. So that's a blow for the ACC. Brian Kersey is going to have to find someone else for Charlotte. And really in the NCAA tournament, he would have gotten, you know, a regional final weekend. He would have gotten potentially a Final Four assignment. There's an opportunity for someone, a hole that has to be filled. But more than that, feel bad for Mike, who's a friend of the podcast.
He is. Mike's a terrific guy and a terrific referee. I talked to him when he originally got injured. I thought I'd lay low a little bit and let him, get his stuff back together. But I did talk to Brian Kersey and did just what you said. I said, Brian, you got a big hole to fill. I says, having a Mike Eads go down, I know somebody else will step up. But when I talked, and that was just recently, as early as this morning, and I wished him luck. He told me, I think he had six more dates. So you could tell Brian Kersey's counting the dates. And I just says, I sure hope you don't have anybody else get injured this week, because now you are really reaching. But, for everybody that comes up injured, another guy gets an opportunity. And I mean, hopefully they make the most of that opportunity. It certainly happened when I was a supervisor, and I think a guy will step in there and do a really good job. He won't be a Mike Eads, because that guy's hard to replace, but there'll be somebody that'll do a good job.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, injuries are part of the game. We've talked about it. It's unfortunate, but we wish Mike the best. Let's talk to someone who doesn't wish. Let's talk about someone who does not wish officials the best. So Fran McCaffrey, after Iowa's loss at Ohio State, went off on the officials in a hallway, called we don't know which official. It may have been the entire crew, a cheating MF-er. We'll protect the sensitivity of delicate ears, but was suspended for two games by the Big Ten. That's as far as I've ever heard a coach go with criticism of an official, to say that, not in a press conference situation, but certainly where everyone could hear it. Is that stuff happen more behind the scenes than we're aware of, or is that exceptional?
It's exceptional. When I refereed, there's been very few cases, but, it's happened. And, but again, Luke, it doesn't happen. Most coaches are under control. But Fran McCaffrey, this is not the first time. My son had a game at Iowa, and where he got Fran McCaffrey got a couple technicals that came out on the floor. He's flailing his arms. I don't know what was said then, but he had to be going. I'm a little, I don't know the people at Iowa or the AD or even the conference commissioner, but I mean, you start MFing and calling the official MF cheater. That means, you get two game suspension. I know I'm a referee at heart, obviously, but if that referee turns around and says something similar to Fran McCaffrey, that you're an MF and get the hell out of here, that referee is never refereeing another game in the Big Ten. He's he's done. But a two-game suspension, it tells me, you know, well, that's a, to me, that's a slap on the hand.
In that game, Connor McCaffrey, Fran's son, received a technical foul, and then Fran got a technical foul. I don't know if there are any other members of the McCaffrey family in the building that day who could have gotten technical fouls, but they
Know.
Got their money's worth.
They you know, and that guy represents that university, and he's a public figure, and conduct like that. That's just unacceptable. Maybe his AD took him to and said, you know, the next time there won't be a next time. And maybe his AD did that. I don't know. But that's just like, that's just so bad.
Yeah.
For a head coach to do that. I mean, like, it's not the first time. There's been other coaches that, that flipped out, you know, but.
That seemed, you cheating MF-er, you're an effing disgrace, seems a little bit over the line.
It is over the line.
Even for, I mean, I don't know, who knows what we don't hear, but that seemed to push it. I like Fran, I mean, I respect his passion, but this is clearly over the line.
But I would ask, if I was, are you out of control? I mean, is this a situation where you can't control yourself? I mean, There's a process where Fran McCaffrey could have taken, other than running the official down and calling him an MF cheater. So, in my mind, if I'm the AD, I scratch my head. Do I have a wacko coach here?
Yeah. One of the three officials in that crew, one was Brian Dorsey, who works a lot of ACC games. One was Steve McJunkins, who I don't know, who works a lot of Big Ten games. He was actually... Talk about a rough week. So on Wednesday the 20th, he was reprimanded by the Atlantic 10 for the game on Wednesday the 20th, February 20th, for a clock error at the end of the St. Bonaventure LaSalle game that allowed St. Bonaventure to win that game. So he was, the A10 issued a rare public reprimand to that crew, and then 6 days later he's bearing the brunt of Fran McCaffrey's wrath. So he's continued to work since. Obviously the Big Ten Mac and Horizon Leagues didn't have an issue with that, but talk about a tough 6 days.
Oh yeah, you know, he's probably was still so concerned about getting hammered by the Iowa coach that he probably had that on his mind. I don't know, but you know, I know the situation and that happened in the Atlantic 10, and all three of those guys should have been privately reprimanded. They should have taken care of the clock at the end, and they have replay there that they could go look at. So they put it back where Brian Kersey has to act on them, and no supervisor, Luke, likes to do that, but it was probably necessary.
Speaking of technical fouls, some crazy goings on in Greenville last Wednesday, the 27th, East Carolina playing Houston. And things got a little crazy.
Yeah, I didn't see it. I just read about it and saw where head coach got two technical fouls, and then a player got ejected also, and then apparently they had to get a fan out of there, and just became a total mess.
So Joe Dooley got the first tech. And then East Carolina guard Isaac Fleming got the second one. And then Dooley and the fan. Dooley got a technical and was ejected. The fan got ejected.
I don't think you can tee a fan up.
No, I think you just throw him out, right?
Right. Yeah.
And then another ECU player.
Got a technical.
Sean Wong got a flagrant one that was changed to a flagrant two on the monitor.
Oh,
and then he got ejected. So here's what Dooley said. He called it, quote, a debacle. I'll take partial responsibility, and there's some other parties I think should take partial responsibility. I'm very unhappy our fans had to witness it. It's the first time in 31 years I've gotten tossed. I think our guys lost their composure a little bit, and you can't do that against a top 10 team. And then he said, he also said, I think there were a number of people who lost control tonight. And I swear he said something about we got to do a better job. Yeah, here it is. We need to play better. They need to ref better.
Oh, so okay. I'm not sure I saw that, but you know, this time of year is so stressful for everybody. I think officials are counting the number of games they have left. The supervisor is trying to finish up the season. Coaches, East Carolina, I'm trying to see their record, but East Carolina is 3-13 in the league. They're at the bottom of the league, just ahead of Tulane. That, Luke, that all builds up and there's combustion. And the players are frustrated. Nobody's achieved their goals. And in one place you can start pointing the finger is fans start pointing it at the coach, and the coach, many of coaches start pointing at the referees, and the referees are, it's a tough time of the year. Everybody is tired. These officials have been at it, as the coaches, as the players have, for a long season, and sometimes it just boils over.
Sure seems that way. You know, let's not forget, this is Joe Dooley's first year at East Carolina. He's trying to rebuild that program, really build that program into something. It's a tough job.
Very tough job.
And he's, I think, to a certain extent, Houston comes in, and Kelvin Sampson has rebuilt that program. Mm-hmm. It's a top 10 team, or it was at the time. They're winning. They're going to be a top 4 seed in the NCAA tournament. You know, Houston's on to something. That's where Joe Dooley's trying to get to. So having a chance to take a stand in front of your fans, even if it means getting thrown out, I mean, it's kind of saying, hey, we're not going to get pushed around anymore.
You know, he may have that thought in his mind, you know, let me just see if I tell my fans that I'm fighting for the team, I'm fighting for this program. But East Carolina is in a different spot than Houston. Houston had some tradition. They've had some winners. They've had a Hall of Fame coach. Somebody tell me the last time East Carolina was any good, Luke.
Well, they won the CBI a few years ago. Now, that's not the NCAA tournament, but that's still something. But Jeff Lebo was the coach.
Oh, Jeff was coach. And there's a great guy. But, again, that's such a hard job.
It is a hard job. I'm of the opinion, I mean, obviously, I think East Carolina is always going to be a football school. That's just the nature of the beast, that East Carolina is going to be a football school first. But that said, CIT, not CBI. I meant the collegeinsider.com, okay. Not the CBI. That's my error. But in this state, in North Carolina, within these boundaries, there should be enough players. There should be enough talent. You should be able to win there in that conference in basketball. Maybe not at the level of a Houston right now, but you should be able to be competitive. I mean, you know, Kai Bowman wanted to go there. You know, maybe would have gone. So, you know, there's talent here that's getting out of state that needs to, you know, that East Carolina can leverage into a better situation. I think Joe Dooley has a chance there to get that program on the right track. If you look at his track record, what he's been able to do, where he's worked, and obviously he was coached at East Carolina. Yeah. He knows the landscape. He knows what's going on there. You know, I think he's got a chance. It's not going to be easy, but he's got a chance.
You know what would be an accomplishment, a goal? I'm looking at the schools. If he could finish in the upper half, even if it's the bottom of the upper half, I mean, UConn's going to be good. Cincinnati, Houston, UConn, and you know, you're going to get you're going to get SMU. I would think that they could get. You know, so if he can. If he can start winning some games and finishing the upper, that'd be a good goal.
I mean, it's a tough conference. You've got programs that are traditionally good. Cincinnati's traditionally good. Temple, traditionally good. Memphis, traditionally good. Wichita State, traditionally good. And Connecticut. Those programs may be up and down, and Connecticut, obviously, and Wichita State this year are both down a little bit. But, you know, if you can get into where you're in that group more years than you're not, you'll be in good shape. But I've always found that to be a fascinating program down there, just because there's so much talent in this state. The American is obviously not terribly far behind the Power 5 conferences or Power 6 in basketball. This year ahead of the Pac-12. I mean, everybody's ahead of the Pac-12. You know, so, you know, it's a good conference. It's a tough league for a school like East Carolina, but I think it's doable.
Think about the kid from Havelock, Bowman, that plays at BC. That's right in their backyard. If they could have got somebody like that, I mean, he's a good player. And you know, maybe like you say, there are good players out there. They've got to start getting some of them.
Let's switch gears to one of our favorite topics, which is the block charge.
No, okay. Perfect.
Well, you
no, we're going to talk about the block charge, absolutely.
Which one do you want to talk about first?
Well, I'll
Mississippi,
tell you,
Tennessee?
Yes, I do.
Okay, let's start with Mississippi, Tennessee.
You know, it was a really, really good game. I didn't see all of it, but I did see some of it. And, you know, Tennessee scores right at the end, and they think they have this game. And a kid takes it down, and this is, in my opinion, it is simply a charge, 100%, or excuse me, a charge, and a Mississippi kid, Tennessee kid takes it, and it's the end of the game, basically game over. And we talked, Luke, about block charges repeatedly. And a kid steps in front of a kid that's trying to take a desperate shot, and he runs right into him. The Mississippi State coach takes his coat off.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of technicals. Officials have a hard time getting out, as did Tennessee, getting out of the arena without getting pelted with a bunch of garbage being thrown on the floor, being thrown at the referees. And it's a loss. But officials had nothing to do with the outcome of the game. And I'm saying that not in jest, because they made the right call. You could not pass on the call. And the kid is standing there, and he gets run over. What I would say is, do you want us to not call it? Do you want us to just walk away from this call and say, you know, this game's going to be – I'm just going to walk away. You know, that's not what you're getting paid to do.
You get
the responsibility of refereeing a game for 40 minutes, not 39 minutes and 50
seconds. Yeah, John,
seconds.
I don't think that's the issue. I don't think anyone's asking anyone to just swallow their whistles in the last minute or last 10 seconds or whatever. I'm with you on that. And it's not even a mechanical thing. It's not, well, how would you change the rule? I think it's a philosophical thing that we need to look at as a sport, as the game of college basketball. Here's what's happening. In that game, in the Nevada-Utah State game, with Caleb Martin's dunk that a guy just stands in the way, we have guys making unbelievable offensive plays. Dunks, great shots, really talented plays, difficult plays, hard to execute. And then we have defenders just standing in the way. We're penalizing good plays and rewarding the worst play in the game is just standing there. That's how you win games these days. Just get in the way and stand there. Like that stupid inbounds charge they call, where the guy gets in the way of the offensive player running the baseline.
Running the baseline.
And just standing there. That's dumb. Now, is that by the book a charge? Yes, I get that. I'm not criticizing referees for calling it that way. They're going to get reprimanded if they don't. I'm saying we need to have a philosophical discussion about rewarding players for doing things that take skill and not rewarding something that takes no skill, and we're penalizing players for things that are difficult and rewarding them for things that are easy. I hate that. I hate this stupid charge stuff where we're penalizing players for good plays because some other dope figured out he could go stand in the way with his hands at his side. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it.
You know, Luke.
I hate it, John.
No. And you're preaching to the choir here. I tell you, I don't like it. I didn't like it when I refereed. The officials don't like it. My son says what we need to do is every time there's a block charge, every single time there's a block, just call it a block. These guys will stop it.
Here's the thing.
Just call a block. If the guy gets run over and knocked into the second row and it's the most obvious charge, call block.
Okay. I think Tim may have gone too far on that. But I would like to see a charge be an out-of-control player. Someone who's fumbling with the basketball and plows over his man. Someone who that lowers his shoulder, who raises an elbow.
Extends his arm.
Yeah. The whole deal.
Separation, all that. Yeah.
To get an advantage.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, you're penalizing a guy, and he's not getting any advantage. Mm-hmm. He didn't choose to run over that guy. He just is going to the basket, and some idiot's in his way, who is not even playing defense. He's just standing there. the phrase player control foul. Let's go with that. Let's dig into that language. If you're out of control, then stick your hand behind your head and point the other way. Mm-hmm. If you're just driving to the basket and someone gets in the way, call the charge and move on. So I think Tim's right about that part. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, let's reserve the charge for charging. When you are charging into someone, when you are put your head down and you're not even looking where you're going, that's an offensive foul. Trying to dunk and having a kid jump in your way, that's dumb. Yeah. And we've tried to fix that with the whole they have to be there before you leave the ground and all that stuff. And that's fine. But there's a bigger philosophical issue. And I know I'm ranting here.
No, you're
not ranting.
There's
a bigger philosophical issue where we're not rewarding good play. Yeah. We're penalizing good play. And that's not the spirit of the rule book.
Right.
That's like, we talked about this a little bit, the 30-second violation, where it was in the Carolina-Virginia game, where Virginia had a 30-second violation. Carolina's going the other way with the ball for a layup.
Right.
But because Carolina didn't have possession at the exact moment the shot clock expired, it's whistled dead. It basically took 2 points off the board.
2 points.
All right, that shouldn't be the spirit of the rule. I'm not saying we have to play the advantage like in soccer, but how about you don't blow the whistle until the offending team has possession?
The referee would say, "Okay, what happens in the interim there? What if he loses the ball or something, and you can't?" So there's always
I understand that. I understand.
I'm with you on that. But the rules committee and the coaches, I don't know what all the coaches' feelings are, but I will tell you. When I had to go to practices and sit and watch their practices, they spend time and time and time getting a secondary defender over there to stop the play going to the hoop. And a coach would say, so what we're going to do is just get out of their way and let them dunk the ball or let them make a layup.
Yeah, okay? I know.
So no. So I'm coaching, and my guy on the perimeter gets beat, and I've got two big guys inside. And one of them, I'm going to tell them to take a charge, or I'm going to say, let's forget about taking the charge. How am I going to make this play? I'm going to try to block the shot.
No,
I'm playing the devil's advocate.
I understand that. Yeah. I would like to see the secondary defender have to actually try to make a play on the ball rather than just plant his feet.
Right.
And maybe I'm being hyperbolic here because I hate this play so much. I think there is, in college basketball, there is such a thing as a charge.
But
I just don't think. I just don't think it's it. And I know that we've evolved to that. I know that players are taught to do that. I know that the game's been officiated that way. But I think for the good of the game, we need to look at that and say, is this really how we want this to go? Do we really want to encourage this as opposed to a guy who's moving his feet and playing defense and the offensive player lowers his shoulder and runs him over and it's called a block because the guy was moving? When he's actually trying to play defense. You see that all the time.
Yeah.
It's like, why is that a block and not a charge? That guy actually got charged into, and he's moving his feet and trying to play defense. And you do see the charge called on a defender who's moving. You do see it.
Yeah.
But it's a trickier call. And the opposing
coach, a lot harder call.
The opposing coach is going to go berserk and say, he's moving, because we've gotten into this moving stationary thing. It should be, are you playing defense or are you getting in the way? Anyway, we've been here before.
No, be interesting if we had JD on here and see what JD Collins and see what his take would be on it. But or even Art Highland, the national coordinator for officials. But the NBA will take a charge every once in a while, but they don't take a lot of them.
No, that's the other thing is, the NBA has figured a way around, and I don't watch enough NBA on a nightly basis to tell you how they've done that.
I don't know either. They don't want their stars getting in the way of
But they want to reward good plays. Yeah. If there's a dunk like
entertainment, that's right.
Yeah.
That's
if right. There's a dunk like Caleb Martin's in the Utah State Nevada game, where he takes off from 30 feet away and throws it down, and some guy from Utah State just happens to be under his flight path, and they call that a charge, essentially giving the game to Utah State at that point.
That's right.
Now, I'm not saying it was the wrong call. I'm not criticizing the
official.
But that would never be called in the NBA.
No.
It'd be on a freaking poster. You'd be able to buy it on NBA.com.
Yeah, and they'd be telling that guy to get up.
Yeah. Well, maybe don't get in his way next time would be the advice. That's the call is don't get in his way. but we need to get there too, as college basketball as a sport, I think. And
I think our listeners are going to enjoy that, and maybe we'll get some feedback from some of the listeners how they feel about that.
I mean, that's a great idea. I mean, let's go ahead right now and make it clear we are soliciting feedback on solutions. Or if you think it's the way it is, just because I feel that way and because you sort of agree with me in some ways.
I do.
Doesn't mean we're right.
And referees do also. You know, but the referees are also going to be judged on their decision making.
Absolutely.
And so they can't turn a blind eye to it. But
the way the game is supposed to be officiated now, that is a charge.
That's right. Or a block.
I mean, but I'm not criticizing that. I'm not saying they're calling it wrong. I'm saying we need to have a much bigger philosophical discussion about what we want a block to be, what we want a charge to be, and how can we do this for the good of the game, to reward players for good plays and not penalize them for good plays, which I think is what's happening. Sometimes a charge is just a charge. I'm not saying get rid of it, but I am saying let's take a look at some point. Yeah, the problem with this, John, as you know, is coaches are going to hate it because it's a lot easier to say go play defense by getting in someone's way than it is to actually go play defense. They love it because it's a lot easier to stop a player by sending a secondary defender to go stand 3 inches outside the circle and plant his feet and get run over. And hey, that's a dead ball turnover. We're going the other way.
Well, just one more thing about that. The worst possible charge, worst possible play, is that play being away from the ball that has nothing to do with the ball, and you find somebody running up the floor looking back to get an outlet pass or something.
Sure.
And I see him coming, right? And I can get in front of him, and the ball's not even coming to me. The ball's going, and I can get in front of him, and that guy knocks him over. And what do we got to charge? And I'm thinking, what does that have to do with basketball?
It's funny, unrelated, there's a great video of Trevor Lawrence, the Clemson quarterback, playing pickup basketball, and he's coming up the court after a basket, and some guy decides he's going to set a screen and pick him. Can you imagine being the kid who knocked Trevor Lawrence out?
I want to know what Dabo is letting him play basketball for.
You got to let the kids play, John. A good official should know that. Let the kids play.
Okay. Did you see, there was a play in the... Luke, I'm trying to think who Tennessee was playing, and there was a play at the end where the Tennessee kid ran into, maybe it was LSU, it was LSU, I think, and it was so clear, and then Rick Barnes, the coach of Tennessee, was so upset that he, rather than go shake hands, he came out on the floor, he went after Pat Adams. I believe it might have been Pat Adams, and I thought to myself, this kid that had the ball for LSU had the ball in his possession, and then the contact by Tennessee had it knocked out of his hand, and I didn't get a chance, but it's Rick Barnes was talking about it, I think on YouTube, and I didn't get a chance to hear what Coach Barnes had to say, but it was such a clear foul that it wasn't even it was Anthony Jordan that made the call.
All right, so you're talking about that call, the reaching at the end of the game.
Yeah, Anthony Jordan made the call.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, it goes back to say this, that I'm a good friend of Rick. I would say, Rick, what would you can't say that it's your only out was let's not decide the game, which was in overtime. Let's not decide this game on that call because my guy stumbled in to a guy that had the ball and lost the ball. I mean, and I think he would say, let's not make that call in that situation. And I'm thinking, you know, and I'm making this all, I'm surmising that might be what Coach Barnes would say because he can't look at that play and say it's anything but enough contact for that kid to lose the ball and get knocked backwards.
So, regardless of that play, there was a controversy after that game where Tennessee fans found pictures of Anthony Jordan on Facebook wearing an LSU t-shirt.
Good point, yeah.
So what, as a supervisor, as an official, what do you do then? Because the SEC basically said no harm, no foul, and moved on.
That's better for this discussion, for this our session than the play I just brought up. That's a really good Luke. I had that happen. I had received a phone call similar to that, where I had an official show up at NC State and brought his children in, who had themselves covered in Carolina gear.
Okay.
They're coming to state, the official, the referee, and his kids got Carolina gear on. And how fast do you think I received a phone call?
Yeah.
You know? So what I would say that officials need to be very, very careful. People recognize them. You put yourself on a spot. You put the supervisor. You put everybody in a bad position, and you're stuck on stupid if you can't see that.
Yeah.
If you can't see the issue, you are a neutral person, and that's why we have a policy. If you have any family relation going to that school, you're not refereeing at that school. Okay, that's a written policy. I can't, you know my boys, Luke. Connor is never going to referee a football game at NC State.
Right.
Okay. And not only that, if he takes his wife and kids to some game, they don't need to be dressed in colors that he might be officiating at the
sure.
team. I'm rambling, Luke, but that is so stupid by a referee. And I have had in my 12 years of tenure, I had referees do stupid things just like Anthony Jordan did. But he thought he was innocent. He's overseas somewhere, and he picks up a LSU, and it in the social media picks it up. It's insane.
It is, but you got to be smarter than that.
Smarter, I mean.
I'm
kicking his butt as I'm the supervisor.
For putting you in that position.
That's right. That's right. They're going to put the finger at you bad enough making bad calls. You don't need to say, he lives in Louisiana. He lives in Baton Rouge or New Orleans, and now he's got an LSU game, and he's flashing around with a LSU T-shirt.
Yeah. No, it's hard. And in the social media era, something as simple as you pick up a T-shirt overseas, ha ha. Next thing you know, you're in a game with that team, and bam.
Well, it's his fault, because if he picked up a T-shirt overseas, he doesn't have to put it on on wherever he put it on.
Yeah. That's why you're not on Twitter.
I'm not on Twitter.
You don't want all those embarrassing pictures of you in Michigan gear out there.
Michigan gear. No, I have I have enough sense to keep it low profile. We had a guy that was Luke. I had a guy that worked as a press person with the Bush administration come speak to us, and he spoke about that. He says, "You are a recognized celebrity, public figure, whether you believe it or not, and everything you do can come back to you." I told our referees in our annual preseason meeting, don't text anything. Don't text your brother-in-law, say, coach and coach tonight that I had was a pain in the backside. Because the brother-in-law is going to send it to five of his friends. Okay? And five of his friends are going to send it to 25 yeah. more friends. And if that circles around that you said that coach was a pain, you might get fired.
Yeah. No, it's a good point.
Do you think they listen to?
No, probably not.
They don't listen. They don't listen.
No one listens, John, except to our podcast.
Well.
Which we ought to just call the Block Charge Show next time.
I saw a different side of you today. You were really passionate about a couple of things.
Whatever. I'm just here for the goats. But I do think that is an area worth looking at. Maybe not in this year's rule change process, but I mean, I think that's
is there a way
conversation.
Do you have any ideas? I mean, we're going back to talking about block charge, Luke. Do you have any ideas how to solve it?
No, as I said, I mean, I would look kind of what the NBA typically does. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've basically gotten that kind of defense out of the way, you know, out of the game. I would, not to reiterate or belabor the point, I'd like to see really talented players rewarded for being really talented, and less talented players have to actually play defense. And if they foul, then that's part of being less talented.
Mm-hmm.
The game should be a meritocracy. That's my position. Anything else you want to add, John? I think today in particular we've rambled on long enough.
Well, we did, but I tell you, last thing I would say, you have the pen, you have the paper, you write.
Get to work.
You write commentary, people read, so lay it out there.
Well, hopefully they're listening to this, and yeah, I'll write something at some point. My plate's a little full at the moment, but maybe we'll talk about it again next time.
Well, we'll have plenty to talk about. We got tournament coming up. You know, we got the teams fighting for a spot in the NCAA. You know, that's going to be critical. And I'm sure as the season winds down, there'll be more plays to talk about, the game-ending plays. One last thing, Luke, and I know we're probably running way over, but I had always told my officials, the plays that are going to kill us are game-ending plays.
Yeah.
Nobody remembers any plays up until that Utah-Nevada game or the Mississippi-Tennessee game. They can't tell you any of those plays.
But the end.
The end.
The end.
You got to be
like
right.
Like that Duke-Virginia game?
Got to be right at the end.
The guy's foot on the floor?
For
the Duke-Virginia game?
Yeah. The Duke-Virginia
game. Brian still says.
You know, Brian says he, and I saw it, and I said, boy, I don't think that guy.
I don't think there's. Anyway, we're rambling on. We've discussed it before. There's no way you can make that call in real time. If you watch the video at full speed, it looks like his foot is off the floor.
Yep.
It's only when you freeze the frame that it's still there.
Foot's still there. Anyway. It's incredible.
Very close play. I still think you got it right. Anyway, we can talk about that again next time. So thank you for listening. Hope the audio was better this time. As always, send your comments, concerns, ideas on how to fix blocks and charges. LDECOCK @newsobserver.com @LukeDecock on Twitter. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.